The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cause, but I think you already knew that if you clicked in. If you're new, thanks so much for checking it out. This interview today is going to be with Dan Sullivan from Prince Edward County. In fact, the next couple podcasts are going to be with different winemakers: Caroline Granger from Grange, Colin Stanners from Stanners Vineyard. I was in Prince Edward County and I was able to bang out a whole bunch of interviews with some just really cool, accomplished people. And I just shout out to all of them for giving their time for me. They all could do it over the span of one weekend, so I was able to do that. A little thought. And I know I've talked about it before, but it really is true. If you have a chance to go to these wineries, go during the off season if you can. I know it's not as gorgeous as, you know, some weekend in the summer, and especially somewhere like Prince Edward County, you know, it's great to go there just because of the beaches and everything else. But if you go during the off times or during the week, you'll get to spend more time talking, you know, sometimes to the owners, to the winemakers. They're around more, and you can get just sort of a better sense of what makes these wineries tick. So just a little thought there. Also, in the news, again, you know, climate change comes up all the time on this podcast because climate and, you know, and winemaking are basically as linked as any two things possibly can. And none of Germany's, I just read this today, none of Germany's 13 wine-growing regions got the necessary temperature, which is minus 7 degrees Celsius, to produce ice wine in 2019. It was the second warmest year on record globally. And it is crazy to think that there will be no ice wine from Germany in the 2019 vintage. Absolutely nuts. And it, you know, A, makes you appreciate the Canadian ice wine, and B, is a reminder that, you know, that product, you wonder why it is so expensive. It's because these winemakers do all this work, dedicate these vines for ice wine, and then, nope, can't do it. It's all been wiped out and destroyed, and all the money and resources that go into making that wine is now a waste, and now you're just kind of waiting for the next year. So, as I said, this interview, it's going to be a two-parter, and it's going to end part one a little bit abruptly, but the end of a statement, end of a thought, and it ends with us talking all about the soil of Prince Edward County, of Rose Hall Run, and the differences in the vineyards that Dan Sullivan works with. And then part two, it starts up with us barrel tasting some of his other Chardonnays and some of his library Chardonnay. So go check out Prince Edward County. I've said it before. I mean, it's just a beautiful area, beautiful Pinot, beautiful Chardonnay. It is the Burgundy of Ontario. And that's enough of me yammering. Time now for my interview with Dan Sullivan. Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And this is a new one for me. I'm down in the cellar, standing up. We're right next to all the barrels, and I'm joined by Dan Sullivan from Rose Hall Run here in Prince Edward County. Dan, thanks so much for doing the podcast.
Matthew, my pleasure. Nice to have you here, and thanks for braving the weather.
Oh, yeah, it was okay. Like, there was some snow drift on the 401 from Toronto, but it was an easy drive. It's around 11 in the morning on Saturday. So you were telling me before, and you know, I did some research, just obviously in your own background, is that you started as more of an amateur winemaker. How much background did you have in wine before you decided, I want to make wine?
Well, I think that my background more pertains to loving wine so I started as a wine enthusiast, but my former life also has a fair bit of chemistry background.
I worked
in the industrial chemical field for the better part of a decade, and so a lot of the basic background, it's not particularly applicable to what I do in winemaking anymore, but it certainly doesn't hurt to have a good basic understanding of the some of the underlying chemical principles that are going on with winemaking. But really, it started with real enthusiasm for really good wine.
And that's what I found interesting is that you, like, there's some do the journey where they study and they were, you know, working vineyards in Europe and they were at UC Davis. And for you, I mean, you had the science background, but it was more just for someone who loved wine, which I found fascinating. And we'll get into the chemist stuff a little bit later on. But I mean, first, just for everyone who doesn't know, how many years have you been, making wine here at Rose Hall Run?
So at Rose Hall Run, we planted the first vines in the spring of 2001. We had bought the property, my partners and I, the previous autumn. And so our first crush here was 2004. But my first foray into winemaking was actually in 1995. And myself and a group of like-minded friends decided that we'd go on a little adventure. And we all pitched in a couple of $100. And I drove down to Niagara. And I met grape growers and people that were growing growing down there, and I bought some of their stuff. So I didn't start with the whole kit thing. My taste in wine didn't really was running more to like good Bordeaux, and you know, I had a little exposure into Burgundy and stuff like that. And I just happened on somebody that had made some homemade wine, and I believe it was probably a Vidal. And I think
makes sense for Canada.
And the thing that struck me about it was how fresh and unique. And I remember the wines being a little bit high in sulfite and not really being able to identify exactly what that was. It didn't smell particularly bad or anything like that, but it was really intriguing with the freshness. And I thought, arrogant me, that I bet if you put your mind to it, you could do something really interesting here. And it was kind of at the beginning of the curve of I think when Ontario wines were really starting to take off, and that was in the mid-90s, 95. And so I drove down, and I was fortunate enough to meet some really great people down there that, for lack of a better term, mentored me, not so much in the winemaking, but certainly in what it took to grow good grapes. Mm-hmm. And the people that I credit mostly with that are two. The first are the Funks, who were the co-founders of 13th Street Winery.
Yep.
And they've since sold it, and then the other one is a gentleman by the name of Gerald Close, and Gerald has a family vineyard down on, I believe, Line 2 on Niagara on the Lake, and Gerald is the chief viticulturalist for Artera Canada. So he's been with Vincor and then Constellation and then that, but just a super gentleman, incredible grape grower, and immensely knowledgeable. And I don't know what possessed him to sell a lowly amateur like me a couple of grapes, but
yeah,
I made some great Chardonnay and great Cab from his property.
I was going to say, what do you remember from those first wines you made in the mid-90s? And before you continue, this is the second time doing an interview in Prince Edward County where an animal is going to be involved. Last time it was Keith's dog, Kistler, at Clausen Chase. And what is the name of your cat?
Oh, Charlie's coming up to say hi to you.
Hello,
there
Charlie.
He is. Yes. So that's Charlie, short for Charlie Chaplin. He had a brother named Buster, and Buster was the wild one, and he went out one night and didn't come home.
Aww.
And but Charlie's still here, so he's our little mascot and mouser, and he does a great job with both. Don't even think about it.
Don't jump on my computer. That's what I'm going to tell you right now, Charlie.
Yeah.
So yeah, what were your what were those first wines like?
So oddly, you know, they were a little hit and miss, but there was, I guess we made one or two wines that were hits, and so it kind of led me to believe that there might be a bit of a future in this. So I kind of pursued it, and it went from being a kind of an interesting hobby to being something that was kind of all consuming. So I read tons of books and did a lot of study, and you know, I guess the best place for study is sort of the school of hard knocks. And
yeah,
I made a pile of wine back when I was an amateur, and I had a business. Lynn and I had a business in Toronto, and I sort of sectioned off a little part of that, and I started buying small barrels. What are they called? Demi fouettes. They were 54-liter barrels. They'd comfortably hold a demijohn, about six cases of wine, and so even in the early days, you know, I was kind of getting a little bit more used to, you know, more standard types of winemaking and élevage, and there's actually a very, very great community of amateur winemakers in the province, and it's called the Amateur Winemakers of Ontario, and I was fortunate enough to fall into a club called the Pickering Wine Guild, And there's a number of people that were in that club with me that followed me later into Prince Edward County that are now operating wineries.
Which is sort of where I wanted to go. What drew you to Prince Edward County? You made some Chardonnay and some Cabernet in Niagara. So how do you go from the Bordeaux of Niagara to the Bordeaux of Ontario to the Burgundy of Ontario, which is Prince Edward County?
So, funnily enough, at that time, there was a group on the early internet days of a chat group, and they were talking about more sort of outlying kind of areas where grapes were being grown in Ontario, and mostly it was focused on some of the newer hybrids that you're seeing now. But but I remember going to a gentleman by the name of Don Eastman's place, who is a great grower and friend, and tasting. We had a round table where some of the top amateurs and a woman named Deborah Paskus, who you may have heard of. She was the former winemaker at Kloss and Chase.
Oh yeah.
And she was a partner at one time in 13th Street. Anyway, her and another gent and myself and then a number of other people were around the table, and she had talked about some land that she and some friends, who turned out to be Seton McLean and Sonia Smits, had purchased in Prince Edward County. And in the summer of 2000, I'd been going back and forth with a couple of people and decided to take a trip out. And we ended up pulling into what is the property next door, which at the time was called Pedalston Wines, and Mike Pedalston was the sort of sweat equity and co-founder of that property. And I'd been going back and forth with him a little bit, and I went and we pulled in, and it was the Saturday morning on the August long weekend, August 1st, and Lynn and I hopped out of our van, and we looked down at the soil, and we looked up at each other, and we looked back down at the plowed soil, and it was all full of rocks and clay, and I guess we collectively picked our jaws up off the ground, because it looked like some of the really, really great spots that we had walked in France. And at the time, it kind of reminded me a bit of Burgundy and a bit of actually walking through Chateau Beaucastel, because of the stoniness. The rocks are obviously different and stuff like that, but it was, you know, knowing that those kind of stony soils quite often, and limestone, had a great propensity for being able to grow really good grapes. So, and at the time, there were a couple of vineyards established. I think we were probably predated, obviously, by Pedalston Wines, which is now Casadia, by 2 years, I guess. And then there were a couple of other growers like James down at Long Dog and Kloss and Chase, which put their first vines in, I think, in 98, and a lot of them died because of the cold winter. And then the following year, I think they commenced replanting again. So so we were sort of on the at the sort of midpoint of that first wave of people that came in, and in the fall of 2000, in the spring of 2001, that's when a lot of the very serious plantings went in, and aside from the aforementioned ones, Huff Estates got their start that year. The Grange planted their first vines that year. We planted our first vines.
Did that make it easier for you in terms of just, like, I imagine whenever you're the first for anything, there's also, like, there's an insecurity, a trepidation when you're the tip of the spear. Did it make you feel at least a little bit more comfortable knowing that very close to you were other like-minded people that also had faith in the terroir?
Well, yeah, I think. I think in those days it was relatively early days, and I think if we knew what could have been ahead, as far as the trials and tribulations, maybe there's a number of people that would have thought a lot more a lot harder about how torturous this yeah. journey would be, but we were all in. We had bought the property, we got our vines in the ground, and then what it was learning to adapt, and so we did, but you know, not without you know, some painful lessons winter and stuff.
What were some of the, sorry to interrupt, I've always sometimes love to hear the specific stories, like torturous and tough winters, and hearing about Klaus and Chase and how the winter killed it. Like, if you could take me to, what do the hardest moments look like for you, especially in those first couple of years?
So in the first couple of years, I think really it was the stress of biting, just going into something without, with having a good basic sort of book knowledge of what was supposed to happen. But, you know, I was a city kid. I was used to making wine a little bit. I was probably one of the more experienced people out here at that time.
So you weren't a farmer. You were a city.
No, I was a city kid.
You were against the
I law. Hopped you... on a tractor, and yeah. This is a line that I've said before, but I hopped on a tractor and I prayed I wouldn't kill myself, the vines or other people.
Yeah.
And I took some very good advice from the Funks, and I remember Gunther Funk back in the day taking me out to his 5-acre vineyard, which was beautiful. It's on 13th Street. And walking me out into the middle of his 5 acres and said to me, Dan, look around you. Can you handle this? And
that's intimidating.
It was. And and that was 5 acres. Yeah. And that actually inspired me to dial back what I was going to do, which was go in and plant my entire north block the first year. Mm-hmm. And so we planted a little over an acre of it the first year. And I learned to drive a tractor and manage that. And then the following year, we planted out the rest. And that was actually a very difficult year. So that took us to 7.5 to 8 acres. And it got a little in front of me as far as weed management and there. And the thing is, it's a great idea to put the vines in the ground. And it reminds me of a line, a woman who used to run the University of Guelph Hort program said, anybody can grow vines for 1 year.
Yeah.
So what it was getting them through the winter, and then also just like really kind of mundane things like managing weeds and competition in the vineyard. And so it was a real crash course very quickly on good plant husbandry and viticulture, and a really sobering reminder of, you know, Mother Nature isn't going to wait for your time schedule. She's nature has its own things that are going to happen, and you have to adapt and keep up with it. And I think that kind of stoicism is something that probably underlies a lot of the humility that every farmer probably faces. But I think the toughest year for us was 2015. We lost our crop to a late frost.
How much of your crop?
100% of
it,
almost.
Oh my God! So, I mean, I remember it being a Jesus.
And so it was almost the May 24th weekend, and it was the latest frost that we've had in the 80-year recorded history that they've been keeping records at, you know, up in Trenton anyway. And so the problem with it was 15 was a fairly early spring, so we had leafed out and budded out, and the shoots were about 2 inches long, and they were super tender. And then we had a hard frost, which at that point was about here. It wasn't as cold as some spots, but it still got down to -2, and that was enough to do it. And my lead hand, Jose, who is going into his 16th season with me this year, he's a pretty stoic character, and I had never seen Jose cry, but I saw him cry that day.
Really?
And yeah.
And it just takes one day.
It takes 1 minute, you know. So it took 2 hours, basically.
So 2 hours out of, like, so this is in May. So you're doing the winter pruning. You're burying vines if you have to. You're doing all this work.
We came through all of that.
Oh.
We had done our pruning. Everything was up on the wires. We were off. We were starting to see the beginnings of the little inflorescences, which are bunches that are starting to develop. And we knew we'd have a cold night. And we had hoped it wouldn't be that bad. And there's only so much that you can do. in those circumstances, and even in some spots where they did have frost protection in the form of fans, even they weren't spared damage in a number of those vineyards. And so anyway, it just takes one episode like that, and then later that year we purchased our fans, and if I never have to turn them on again, I'll be the happiest guy in the world. But
that's a good answer.
I expect that that, you know, those episodes may come up, and that's not unique to here. Actually, there are many places, even in Sonoma Napa Valley, the whole cycle can take place. Mm-hmm. It just takes place earlier, and maybe March, if they have an early bud break in March, and then the risk of a frost. So
and here at the you hear about the horrible stories of hail in Burgundy and things like that.
Yeah, and so you really are at the mercy of things that are larger than you are. Mm-hmm. And so you try to look after the things that you can, that you have some control over, and part of that is what's going on in your own vineyard as far as vine health goes, and good practices to grow healthy fruit and all of those things. And that's what you can manage, so you focus on that and making good wine.
I want to ask you about limestone. I see that Lynn brought a bottle. I don't know if it's stuff you wanted to try. And by the way, I am perfectly fine. If we can't try anything, I'm perfectly fine trying a whole bunch of stuff, whatever you want to do.
Okay, well, since we're down in the cellar, we're in very close proximity to wines, both finished and unfinished here. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of in the very early stages of the élevage or raising of our 19 vintage, so we'll use Chardonnay as a reference point. It's mm-hmm. one of the key varietals that we grow here at Rose Hall, and usually they'll tend to be a little bit more evolved and perhaps be a little more friendly to taste than Pinot Noir is on a typical February morning.
I barrel tasted Petite Verdot once. That one laid havoc on every part of my inside of my mouth.
Oh, I can believe it. Yeah. Well, the Chardonnay will be a little more friendly.
Yeah, friendly.
So I think what we can probably do is so speaking of the vagaries of nature and stuff like that, we're here, and so what we can do is we can taste the 19. The 18 is just about to come out of barrel. We're going to be bottling that in March.
Oh, fascinating.
April.
Yeah.
And the end of March, March 31st, April 1st. And we can taste a wine that's fully formed but hasn't gone to bottle, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
We can taste one that's in its very early formative stages. And just a word about that. So our estate Chardonnay, which is called JCR.
Which I want to talk to you about. I want to talk about your 2013 one and just we can get to that. What set that year apart? Because you won a ton of medals internationally, decanter. What was it about 2013 where everything just seemed to... I don't say worked out perfectly because there's always struggle, but what made that year so great?
Well, 2013 was actually a pretty miserable summer for most of it, to be honest with you. And it was a cold summer. It was the summer where it kind of wasn't, because every weekend it seemed like it was freezing cold and kind of rainy. But as it happens here so often, and sometimes not so often, but we had a beautiful, beautiful autumn, and both 13 and 14 were back to back. 13 was a cooler year, but 14 displayed some of the same characteristics at harvest time, and it was dry.
Mm-hmm.
And that is always helpful. And so we were able to kind of tease out a little extra hang time on the fruit. But that's kind of nerve-wracking. 19 was like that as well. It was the latest pick we ever did. So I actually think that there's a lot of similarities between the 19 vintage and the 13 vintage.
Interesting.
This early stage.
19, the way I judge it, just being a stereotypical horrible city guy, is when can I go to my cottage?
Right.
And this year, it was way after May 2-4 weekend, before the, and this is up in the Muskoka area, when the ice finally melted.
Exactly.
Yeah. And 19 so, was a t- it was a yeah it was a slow summer.
It was really late.
Yeah.
And so what that means is, when you're out of the box late, everything comes on late. And what actually compounded here, Rose Hall, and I don't know if any of my neighbors experienced it to the same degree, but it was super. Although it was a humid summer, and there were like like little moments where you maybe got like a little dusting, like a tenth of a millimeter of rain, or what they call a trace. We had no real rain episodes to speak of from essentially mid-June to mid-September. And so we had about 8 or 10 weeks where the largest rainfall that we had was half an inch. And so my vines were actually in drought stress toward the end of it. And so what happens is as they start shutting down, the sugar accumulation slows down as well. So we pushed this right out to the bitter end in 19. The flavor development is incredible. The sugar numbers were kind of average. And which just goes to show, you know, so when they talk about this notion of physiological ripeness.
That's a term you hear all the time.
And sugar. I think to kind of put that in perspective, if you're in a warmer growing region, they might reach that point where they think that the flavors are ripe enough to pick, and they might have 24-25% potential sugar in the grapes, 24 to 25 bricks, whereas here in Prince Edward County it might be 21 to 21.5.
Right.
And so so you know, I'm kind of half joking when I say if you've got Pinot Noir if you're making Pinot Noir at 15% alcohol, you've got Pinot planted in the wrong place. And to me, it really does speak to a cool climate. And that's the thing, that's the payoff with Prince Edward County, is
yeah.
The wines are so elegant without being heavy.
Yeah, it's one of my issues I have with a lot of California Pinot, Sonoma, Russian River Valley. Like, there's some beautiful stuff, mm-hmm. you know, but I liked it more, a little more like the Petaluma Gap, a little more cooler climate. Because some of these big Pinots, I feel like they've blended 15% Syrah into it.
Well, that may or may not be the case. I don't know. And it's funny, we were talking just before we started this. I just came back from California, actually. And so it was all about the Pinot for me this go round. And certainly what's emerged out there is that they're chasing Pinot higher and higher up and closer to the ocean. And I think the thing that we kind of forget is that it is kind of like an Eden there. You can plant things in places where you need very little inputs other than irrigation to keep them going. And I was the person that was touring me around at a place called Occidental, which is owned by Steve Kistler, and he's the head winemaker there. It's his new project. And she explained that it was that they learned how to grow Pinot Noir and other varietals in conditions where there was more coastal fog and more disease pressure. And so I think that the move out to some of these more sort of remote areas up in the hills and that are more affected by coastal fog, certainly like the Carneros region, you know, they are struggling to ripen. And I think that they've discovered that tension that's created with a long hang time and ripening and kind of being, at least by California standards, close to the knife edge, ultimately makes for wines, like when it comes to Pinot Noir or even Syrah, where there's a kind of a knife edge of acidity there that drives the wines. And they tend not to become super jammy and, for lack of a better term, burn off all the elegance that Pinot Noir is famed for.
Yeah.
And you can't make that shit up, to put it bluntly. It's kind of there or it's not there, you know? So if you, if you really want to make, wines that have that sort of beguiling, piece to them, you have to go to places where it's a little edgier and riskier.
Yeah, so, where you can have frost that can destroy a crop.
I guess kind of comes full circle back to the 13. Why is that wine so interesting? It's because it was pushing it right out to the edge of the growing season.
Right.
And still had all that tension there.
So the easy perfect season will not give you your top. It can make yummy delicious wines, but might not get you your top elite wines.
Right. And oddly enough, you know, I find it much more difficult to make good Pinot Noir in really hot vintages than I do in cooler vintages. I prefer cooler vintages. I think they're more forgiving. I think that the underlying structure of the wines, and oddly enough, you know, and this is not just me, and I never really realized it, but I was standing around doing a training session. I think it was for the VQA tasting panel a year or two ago. And we were standing, we were discussing Pinot and how Pinot is kind of counterintuitive in many ways. So I actually find, for example, that cooler vintages can take more new wood in Pinot Noir than hotter vintages. Hmm. Whereas in Bordeaux varietals, it tends to be the other way around.
Yeah.
And likewise with Chardonnay. So I think it speaks to the underlying structure, and that's acidity. And so acidity plays such a key role in the structure of more elegant and delicate wines, that if there's no acidity, and I think it's what got people tired of Chardonnay so quickly, is that they were big, soupy, hot alcoholic wines with a lot of wood overlaying on top of them, and they were tiring to drink. And so I think consumers moved away from that. But I believe that, you know, wood has its place in top wines. But what it needs is to coin a phrase, I don't believe in over-oaked wines. I believe in under fruited barrels. So you need the juice to be able to handle that properly. And when it can, I think it makes spectacular.
So I think the listeners would love to hear just you go through, and I mean, I can edit this if there's pauses. I can take stuff out if you want, like just your impressions of your 19 or of your 18.
Sure.
Literally, you lead the way. Whatever you think.
Okay,
best.
So we're going to go on a little journey here, and let's taste four vintages of wine.
Sure.
Okay. That are going to kind of illustrate what we've got. So we'll go with the two most current ones, which are the 19 and the 18. Mm-hmm. Two very different vintages. 19, as I said, long and cool. 18 was kind of a bit more ideal. Super small crop here at Rosehall Run. We came off of our biggest vintage ever in 2017. The vines took a little bit of a breather and gave me less crop in 18, but we had enough to make, I think, a pretty spectacular little...
How many bottles and cases do you guys make?
All told from the estate here, we're about a little, on an average year, a little over 5,000 cases, right around 5,000 cases. And our total production, which is skewed because we have a couple of wines that I'm actually quite happy with and our certainly consumers love, called Pixie and some of our other ones, where I use mostly purchased fruit for that.
Right.
And so our overall all production now is approaching, I don't know exactly how much it is, but probably somewhere around 14,000 to 16,000 cases.
Okay. So. All right. Well, let's. When you hear me again, we'll have a glass, we'll have something. So we're just going to take a quick pause. And we're back. So what do we have in the glass? I can tell people that Dan went and grabbed the thief and grabbed Chardonnay from four different barrels.
Yeah.
So yeah, what do we have in the glass here?
So what we have is we have our 2019 vintage, we're not sure yet. We think it'll be our JCR Chardonnay ultimately.
And what is that what's the JCR Chardonnay for people who don't know?
So that's our flagship estate Chardonnay. We've been producing that in various forms since our founding into our first vintage in 2004. It's named after my long-suffering partner, John Campbell Reston. Mm-hmm. And so he's too modest to name something after himself, but Lynn and I thought it would be a fitting tribute to our co-founder.
Yeah.
And so it's called JCR, ultimately it's called JCR Chardonnay. And historically it's come from the oldest blocks on the vineyard, which is our North Vineyard. But we, starting in the 2016 vintage, we started including some of the fruit that's grown in our West Vineyard as well, so mm-hmm. which was planted in 2007.
And what do you get on the nose on this fella?
So on this one here, it's still pretty primal. It's funny when we talk about the smells that you get. So I kind of get like a heathery kind of smell. There's kind of a very kind of upfront, almost like an apple blossom kind of element to this.
That's kind of where I was going. Like just this is led by like just it's like very tangy green apple thing.
Right. And so, you know, that's the that speaks to the power of the fruit itself, you know, because as you saw, we picked from, so all of our Chardonnays are done in large format, what are called puncheons. They're 500 liters or larger. We've got an 860 over there. And you saw the upright that that we're going to start employing next year. So what that means is that the impact of the wood is less intense than it would be in a smaller barrel. And this is important for the élevage or the raising program that we do with our wines here. They over-vintage. So what that means is that this particular wine here will spend probably in the neighborhood of 15 to 18 months in the barrel, and with very, very little to disturb it. So there's a technique called batonnage is the French term for it. It's essentially just lee stirring. So what happens is we actually ferment it right from juice in the barrel in contact with the fermentation lees or yeast cells for the entire time that the wine is developing in barrel. And by employing batonnage, what you're doing is you're moving the yeast cells back up into the wine, and they impart a particular type of flavor. And I won't go into all the technical things that are going on there, but I think that they can add a lot of texture to a wine, but I also think that they can impact the aroma profile of the fruit. And for me, and this maybe is a little controversial, but for me, the terroir is about the fruit. And so what I don't want is I don't want a lot of things really interfering with that basic primal element of the fruit that we grow. So I tend not to use a lot of what's called batonnage or lee stirring in our wines, and just enough to kind of get them through the primary fermentation so there's no sugar left in them.
Right.
And then by sitting in the bottom of a barrel, they're in a much more what's called reductive environment, meaning that they're starved of oxygen down there, and they develop in a different way that adds a particular type of character to the aromatics of the wine in that environment versus a wine where there's a lot of batonnage.
Okay. I'm going to have a little mm-hmm. spit. Now, first off, I want to say that I'm... my first spit in a while, like aggressive spit in a while. I was happy with it. I thought I had really good.
You nailed it, my friend.
I thought
friend.
I had good spit control. I think I got the majority in there. I felt very good about that.
There's none on your shoes. Nope. That's always a plus.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you don't wear your good shoes when you're down here.
No, exactly. So I never do. Mm-hmm. So as you can taste, still really young in its development. Still a nice tangy acidity to it, which, you know, I think in the 19s is going to be one of the hallmarks of the vintage, and I hope that it stays there. So I don't really do anything to drive a malolactic fermentation. I'm sure you're familiar with it, but for your listeners,
it's always good just a reminder.
So what happens is there are various forms of organic acids that naturally occur in grapes, and one of them is an acid called malic acid, and it's the same acid that's in apples. And what happens is malic acid can be converted from malic acid into lactic acid, and in the course of doing that, what you do is you soften it, and that quite often is largely responsible for what gives Chardonnay sometimes a little bit of a buttery flavor. There are other mm-hmm. chemicals that are involved in that as well, but that softening of the acidity in Chardonnays, a good chunk of it is largely due to the conversion of malic acid into lactic acid. I tend not to force a lot of malolactic fermentation. There are bacteria that you can introduce to the wine that are selected strains that will do that, but I just kind of let it go naturally here, and whatever the malo ends up being, it ends up being. That's, and
wherever nature takes you, it
exactly.
takes you. And when you tasted that, are you feeling good about it? Neutral? Like you're not trying to go, oh God, we're in trouble or anything like that.
So at this point, you kind of hit on it. What I'm really looking for at this point is I'm looking to see, are we in trouble?
Yeah.
And in most instances, what you're looking for is you're looking for volatility, which is like a lot of sort of aggressive kind of vinegar smells. If it's starting to smell kind of tired or oxidized or sherry-like, those sorts of basic...
Those are the markers you're keeping an eye on.
Basically faults,
yeah,
right?
And none of that was here.
And so my role at this point is just to be sort of the fact checker to make sure that we're getting everything right.
Right.
And so that we're not telling an untrue story about what's happening in the vineyard. And so... So really it's, and the other thing that we've got here is, as you can taste, there was like a little hint of sweetness on the back end of that. So there's a couple of barrels where we'll probably, we'll let them come out of spring and see if the tail end of the ferments finish up. And if not, we'll move them upstairs to a warmer environment and finish them up there. But for the most part, these are evolving pretty much the way that I would expect them to be going. Nice, clean fruit.
Yep.
But did you really taste any wood?
No.
So there you go.
No, absolutely not.
And so the thing is that it takes quite a bit longer time for those flavors to emerge in the barrels. And keep in mind that because it has been fermented in those vessels, Matthew, that you've got an interior coating that has the yeast cells all around it as well. And so what happens is the diffusion of the wood and the vanillin flavors from the barrels into the wine is much more subtle and it's more integrated, which is why there's sort of no shortcut to true barrel fermentations in wood. And it's why wines like this inherently is part of the reason why they can't be cheap. Because, the advantage, though, is I could have done one ferment upstairs in a 5,000-liter tank and then with one yeast and put it all down in here, and they would develop on their own. But you're creating your own little universe in each one of those, nine barrels.
Those barrels aren't cheap.
No, they're not. So the ones that you're looking at there are about $2,400 a piece.
Yeah.
And I'm from the perspective of getting wood flavor, I'm getting wood flavor for two vintages out of them, and then they're neutral vessels, perfectly great for doing my sparkling wine program, for example. But as far as adding that sort of je ne sais quoi of oak to the wine, they're spent. So that's kind of,
So do you want to try? Do you want to try 18?
So now we'll go and we'll pull a sample of the 18, and you'll be able to taste how much more developed it is.
All right, perfect. I'm just going to leave this, and when you hear me again, we will be back. And we are back. The 2018, and I believe Dan, you pulled. I was counting. I think at least six different barrels.
Right. So Matthew, that represents the pinnacle of our Chardonnay production right there. Mm-hmm. So I may produce upwards of 4,000 cases, 5,000 cases of Chardonnay in a given vintage. And you saw the 9 500-liter barrels. So that's 4,500 liters. So that gives you some perspective on what our JCR is.
Right.
It's about the top 10% of our production. And so this is entirely estate grown. It it comes mostly from my North Vineyard that was planted in 2001 and 2002. And this particular vintage was augmented by some of our plantings in our West Block, which was 2007. So obviously you smell a more developed nose.
I was going to say, this one, like, The analogy I always give when I do barrel sampling, something new, is your newest barrels, that's the preview for the movie.
Right.
You know, this one here, the 18, feels like I've been given more of a teaser trailer, like a 8-minute little vignette of what the film is. That's what, I mean, compared to the 19, the 18, you can start to feel, you're becoming Chardonnay.
Right. And that's actually a great way of using an analogy for wine, and I sometimes do it, is that I'm just the editor. So what happens is all the raw footage and the story is shot out in that vineyard, and it's brought in here, and I'm the one that makes sense of it.
That's a good net right there. That's a good net.
And so essentially what we have here is we've got, the characters are more developed. There's more flavor. There's more nuance. There's you get a sense of the personality of what they're like.
Yeah, and a little bit of spice. First off, still, the wood is hard to find.
Yeah, but it is definitely, for me anywhere,
I find it more on the nose than on the palate.
Yep. And so that's what we're looking for, is we're looking for that really kind of great seamless integration that you're getting between the wood and the wine. And that only comes with time. And so that's why it takes as long as it does for this to happen.
When do you release the JCR? Like, what's the aging program for it?
So the élevage, or the aging for this. So this is going to come out of wood in early to mid March, and then we'll do our blend cuts ahead of that and see what makes the cut and what doesn't make the cut. Right now, they all look to be in a pretty good place. And to be honest with you, I've already kind of pre-done some of that work. So my assistants and I, and also some of my tasting room staff, so they kind of know what the final cuvée is more or less going to be like. I may uninclude a barrel or something, but but at this point, they all look to be really solid. And then it'll come out of wood. We'll do a little bit of what's called cold stabilization, meaning we just don't want any crystal, so we'll chill the wine down to make sure it's nice and cold. Some of the natural tartrate crystals will fall out of the wine, and then we make a decision whether we want to filter it or not filter it. And quite often I will, because as I mentioned to you, I don't push a lot of malolactic fermentation.
Yeah.
And what I don't want to have happen is I don't want to have for that to take place in the bottle and for the wine to become fizzy and cloudy again. So quite often, depending on how stable it is and how far the mallow has gone, I'll quite often filter our estate Chardonnay. I don't generally always do that with the Pinot, but with this particular wine, more than likely I will. And
you feeling good about it?
Feeling really good about it. I mean, you tell me. You know, you're the the learned passive taster here.
It's been a couple of years since I got my diploma from WSET.
But there's still really nice, fresh, crisp acidity there. Really good mid-weight, but there's a real, it's not a flavor, it's a texture, it's a weight. And, you know, it's kind of almost like a waxy kind of a feel
in the,
on the back.
Oh, yeah. No, the it's got an, like, you can feel what the finish is going to be, the weight on the mid part, on the mid palate. Like, it's just, it's a well constructed wine.
So for me, when they start talking about nutty qualities in wine, it almost tastes like sort of like a cashew or a kind of a hazelnutty kind of character on the back of the finish there.
Yep.
And so I think that what that is it's a very, very, very subtle kind of oxidation that takes place in the barrels. And so what'll happen is this will come up you know, we try to do as little as we can, to these wines to get them into bottle. But these will probably require a small amount of sulfite, just as a antioxidant, to keep them fresh going into the bottle. And we're of the philosophy here that screw cap is the way to go. And so everything that we do is under screw cap, and so nothing is getting in and nothing is getting out. So what we want is to make sure that the wine is sound and not unstable going into the bottle.
I wanted to ask you, because limestone.
Right.
Whenever you hear about Prince Edward County, why is it so good for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir? It's the limestone, which is a similar soil that you get in Burgundy. But I was wondering if you could, you don't have to go on too long, but even what is it about specifically about limestone? What is it about that soil that helps to make good Chardonnay or good Pinot Noir?
Well, I think that's one of the sort of big mysteries of the wine world is this whole notion of minerality and whether what is in the rock is actually literally translatable to what goes into the bottle.
It is always that controversy about, you know, people will debate terroir, minerality, does it exist? You don't actually taste minerality.
Right.
And some people say terroir is overrated. It's done a little bit to romanticize. It's almost a marketing tool to try to sell wine to people, because you can tell a great story with terroir.
I think that maybe there's a degree of truth to that, but there's also a truth in the fact that wines that are grown in this kind of climate on this kind of soil taste different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you know that from just having tasted a variety of different wines. So it's not a fictitious notion stretch of the imagination. But I think what it is... So without going, I guess, too far down it, one of the things that happens with calcare limestone like this is it has what's called a very high free active lime content. What that means is that the soils are not acidic. They're the opposite. They're basic soils. And so I believe that the way that the vines react to that is probably fundamentally different than what they would react to a more neutral or slightly more acidic based. And I think that the uptake of nutrition, certainly the uptake of magnesium, is more problematic in these types of soils. And that's important because that's one of the molecules that goes into chlorophyll. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that it's not just the soil. I think it's the interaction with the climate that it's in. And I also think that it's no, sort of coincidence that most of a lot of the really, really terrific wines, particularly in the Burgundian sort of scheme of things, take place anywhere around North 40 to North 45 latitude.
Yeah.
And we're at North 44 here, so I think that there's a climatic element with the sunlight. I also believe that it's super, super windy out here, and I think that that, for some reason, plays an influence in the way that the flavors develop. And so in much the same way that, you know, they're talking about coastal fogs coming in and moderating temperature, what happens here at our site is you have the in the daytime, the land warming up faster than the lake does, the warm air is rising off the land, and we're about a mile and a bit from the lake here. So what happens is that cooler air, which is heavier, is blowing off of the lake and coming on shore here. And so what that does is it cools and moderates the temperature here. So what we have is we have a much more sort of moderating climate, even more so than some of the other sites further inland in Prince Edward County. So when people talk to me about, you know, can you taste the differences between plays, I have two responses to that. And the first one is, yeah, but what excites me is I can actually taste the similarities between places. And to me, that transcends winemaking. It transcends a whole bunch of other things, and it speaks to a regional character. And I think that that, from a terroir standpoint, is an underpinning. And where I do think that we tend to get more nuance, certainly out in the west end of the county here, where we're mostly all on Hillier clay limestone or some variation of it, is the proximity to the lake. And I think that that has a very fundamental difference in how the wines taste in different terroirs. So if you're down on Hikes Point Road or around the bend on your way into Wellington where Kente or by Chadsey's Cairns are,
yep,
versus here in Cassidy and Norman Hardy versus further inland toward Clausen and Chase and the Grange, I think that all three of those places have very different potential flavor profiles because not so much because of the soils as because of the climate.
Yeah, you're right. The closer the water versus more central, everything's different.
And not even so much, and so yes, proximity to water, but also the way that sort of the influence of the water is and wind is. So it tends to be windier out here than it does in a lot of other places, right, further inland in the county.
It's interesting. I never thought about that, the role of wind as a moderating factor to where you are, even though it's obvious, but sometimes right in front of your face.
Yeah.
North Block, Silver Fox Block, Hungry Point, like the different spots where you,
right,
where you get your wine. So in these, you can tell some of the differences, but also how they all are somehow connected.
Right, and so Hungry Point is what the old timers used to call our farm out here. If you're farming out at the point, you were going to go hungry. And there's a lot of truth to it. It's very, very hard on equipment. With all the rock and the stone in there, it beats up our farm implements pretty hard. And if you can imagine, you know, using an old steel wheel tractor, or even before that, a horse and a plowshare, it must have been pretty painstaking work trying to get anything done out here.
It's good to be in 2020.
Exactly. More expensive though.
Yeah, that's true.
And however, having said all that, yeah, so there's that terroir. And then, for example, Silver Fox Block, the Nedelco vineyard down on 20 Mile Bench, again, on lime limestone, but a different kind of limestone with a deeper soil. There's a little bit more vigor, more heat units, and so consequently, the wines taste different.
And that's the end of the first part of my interview. I knew when I was talking with him that it was going to go on long. Like, and thanks again for Dan for giving up so much of his time and hanging out down in his cellar. It was just me and him and his cat, which was a very friendly cat. For everyone who thinks that all cats, you know, are just jackasses, it's not true. Some, you know, want to be petted and spend as much time around as dogs. They do exist, but I know there's always the debate. And if you're a dog person, oh, heaven forbid, you can't be a cat person. I don't know why you can't be both. All right, I'm yammering. So that was the end of part one. Part two is going to start up, as I mentioned off the top, barrel tasting, some great Chardonnay, some more stories about just making Chardonnay and hot vintages, plus how being a winemaker is kind of like being Ted Williams. That's all coming up in part two.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.